This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 23, 2004, at WBAI in New York. I'm Deepa Fernandez, with production this week from KUNM in Albuquerque. While most Arabs have come to despise their American overlords, Kurds continue to support the US military. We examine why. Tomorrow is Mumia Abu-Jamal's 50th birthday. And tomorrow is also the largest women's rights march in a decade. We look at the role of women of color.
As the mainstream is looking at abortion, they're really not calling in women of color to weigh in their issues, their concerns.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, has confirmed that it practiced hijack scenarios in the 2 years before the September 11th attacks. More from Kelly Ramirez.
In a written statement, NORAD has confirmed that numerous types of civilian and military aircraft were used as mock hijacked aircraft. Track detection and identification, scramble and interception, and hijack procedures were practiced. According to USA Today, the World Trade Center was one of the imagined targets, and a scenario targeting the Pentagon was not run after Defense Department officials deemed it unrealistic. According to a White House spokesperson, the Bush administration claims no knowledge of the classified NORAD drills. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
The United Nations has sent a fact-finding mission to Sudan to investigate what many describe as ethnic cleansing of black Sudanese by Arab Sudanese militias. Heather Risby has more from the UN.
The UN team arrived in Sudan yesterday after interviewing Sudanese refugees in neighboring Chad for more than a week. Thousands of indigenous Sudanese have fled their homeland to seek refuge in Chad to escape the bloody civil war. The refugees, who, like the militias, are Muslim, made grave allegations of atrocities committed by the Arab militias. Recently, Jan Egeland, a UN official based in the region, said there have been credible reports that Janjaweed militias had committed atrocities, including rape, looting, and destruction of homes against Darfur's black indigenous people. Meanwhile, in Geneva today, the UN Human Rights Commission adopted a resolution expressing concern at the scale of abuses in Darfur region. The United States voted against this resolution because it did not harshly criticize the Sudanese government. Since February last year, about 1 million people have been displaced because of the civil war. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
All the local newspapers in Beijing read the same thing. SARS is back. From Beijing, Severine Bardon reports.
China's health ministry confirmed two suspected cases today, one in Beijing and one in Anhui province. Both of them are medical workers, but two more persons are suspected to have been infected by the Anhui virology researcher, her mother, who died a couple of days ago, and another researcher who had been working in the same center for disease control. China Health Ministry announced today a series of measures to prevent SARS from further spreading. 300 persons who were in close contact with the two confirmed cases have been put under medical observation, and the government will start disinfecting public buildings and take the temperature of travelers at all ports of entry. These measures have been welcomed by the World Health Organization in Beijing, even though the Chinese government delayed giving out the information for weeks. The two confirmed cases started showing up symptoms as early as March the 29th and April the 5th. In covering up for months the spread of SARS last year, China helped the development of a disease that claimed more than 700 lives worldwide. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Severin Bardon in Beijing.
Doctors Without Borders is being denied access by the Italian government to people who attempted to immigrate to Europe, now being held on a small island in the Mediterranean. Diletta Varlese reports in Brescia.
The Italian Internal Affairs Minister refused to negotiate the agreement that allowed the organization Doctors Without Borders to give humanitarian aid inside the center on the southern island of Lampedusa, a holding center for illegal immigrants waiting to be deported. Often the immigrants attempting to reach Italy by crossing the Mediterranean Sea use rubber dinghies and are shipwrecked. The organization said the reason given for the refusal is a report presented to the minister denouncing the inhumane condition inside the center. Loris De Filippi is responsible for the NGO's Italian project.
Now the Internal Affairs Minister forbids us to get in again, and that's a problem because it interferes with the work of an independent volunteer humanitarian organization to give aid and observer for possible human rights violations.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Diletta Varlese in Brescia, Italy.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As funds run low for the U.S. military in Iraq, the U.S. Congress has reportedly begun working on a plan to send billions more dollars to the region. Estimates of a new appropriation varies from the low of $4 billion to a high of $75 billion. Our Capitol Hill reporter Mitch Jeserich looks at what happened to the $87 billion Iraqi package passed just 6 months ago that the White House said would last into 2005.
When the Bush administration came to Congress last year seeking $87 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan, $66 billion of it for the military, it said it would be enough money to last until 2005, long enough to get through the elections. But now that the occupation is costing more than estimated, the administration, made evident by White House spokesperson Scott McClellan, could be considering asking for another multi-billion dollar package sometime soon.
At some point, there would be a need for an additional supplemental in Iraq. And again, we will make those determinations based on what our commanders in the field say.
The chairman of the Joint Chief of Staffs, Richard Myers, told Congress this week that the military may need an extra $4 billion just to make it through the summer. However, the major unanticipated cost of the occupation, according to congressional sources, is the redeployment of troops, many of whom have already served two tours. Along with the cost of moving thousands of troops back and forth from the U.S. to Iraq, redeployment also includes the cost of repairing tanks, helicopters, and other military equipment that have taken a beating in the Iraqi deserts. So even the toughest critics of the Bush administration's policies in Iraq on Capitol Hill are willing to support another supplemental request that could be as high as $70 billion. Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts.
We're not providing the Humvees over there. We're not providing the other essential equipment for our servicemen. That ought to be provided. And that whatever is going to be essential in terms of their security, what is needed is a changed policy.
And what about an increase to troops?
I'm going to support whatever is necessary for the security of the troops that are there, but what we need is a changed policy. This administration doesn't have one.
And the addition of troops in Iraq will increase costs even more so. Dr. Linda Bilmes is a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and she is former Assistant Secretary of Commerce under the Clinton administration. She says the people need to know how much this is all costing them.
Well, if you think about $200 billion, that is, you know, that alone is 10% of the revenues of the country. And we are spending that amount in addition to 25% of the revenues of the country on defense in general. So for everybody who has just finished paying their tax returns on April 15th, you know, they need to think about the fact that fully a third of every dollar that they spend is being spent on military stuff. And that doesn't include homeland security and everything else.
Dr. Bilmes says with a projected multi-trillion dollar deficit over the next 5 years, the insecurity of Social Security as baby boomers set to retire and military action that could cost hundreds of billions of dollars for the time being could all add up to a very unstable economy.
As long as the rest of the world is still willing to invest in the U.S., the U.S. can keep borrowing. But we do leave ourselves vulnerable if at some point the rest of the world, which owns the, you know, a large chunk of the U.S. debt, decides that they don't want to hold as much dollar-denominated debt. I mean, that means that interest rates have to go up, and they have to go up a lot if people and institutional investors worldwide and governments decide they really don't want to hold their debt in dollars anymore. So that is the kind of danger down the road, that we have to keep increasing long-term rates way, way up in order to keep people investing in the country.
Bilmes and others suspect the Bush administration will be approaching Congress for more funds for Iraq in the next couple of months. I'm Mitch Jeserich for Free Speech Radio News.
The Pentagon is angry that photos of the coffins of dead U.S. servicemen and women have been published, breaking a Pentagon policy prohibiting media coverage of human remains. The photos were released last week under a Freedom of Information request. Activists argue that if the American public could see the body bags and the numbers of dead Americans, that support for the occupation would drop dramatically. On the ground in Iraq, today Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr condemned the Basra suicide bombings, but promised that if American troops attempt to attack the holy city of Najaf, he would not be able to control the anger of the people who may commit other such attacks. And while the U.S. Army continues to lock down Fallujah, there remains deep divisions between Iraqi Kurds and Arabs in the way they view the occupation. While most Arabs have come to despise the American overlords, Kurds continue to support the U.S. military. From northern Iraq, FSRN's Aaron Glantz helps to explain why.
60-year-old Abdul Aziz Karim Kumar sits in his backyard and smiles. He's just returned to his village, Ain Helwa, after almost 20 years away. In the late 80s, the Iraqi army was locked in a long war with Iran. Europe and America backed Saddam, and Kurdish guerrillas, tired of Saddam's oppressive rule, sided with Iran. Saddam responded with a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing, bringing large numbers of Arabs from other parts of Iraq to the north, in an effort to break the back of Kurdish nationalism. Before it was over, tens of thousands of Kurds were dead, and more than 100,000 were forcibly relocated. Abdulaziz explains his entire family crammed into a small home in Duhok, a city saved from Saddam's onslaught. He says life was hard.
It was difficult for us to live because we are all poor families. We just wanted to farm. We just wanted to grow wheat and manage our vegetable gardens. We weren't able to do this in the past.
When Kumar and his neighbors returned to Ain Helwa, they encountered Arab families who themselves had been forcibly relocated to the village by Saddam. Kumar says the Arabs left peacefully, but in some places, Kurds have put notices on Arab homes in Kurdish-controlled areas demanding the Arabs leave. And there are reports of Kurdish guerrillas arriving at Arab homes with bulldozers and AK-47s. In an ironic turn of events, at least 2,000 people of Arab descent now live in a refugee camp in Baghdad. Still, Abdulaziz Karim Kumar says, for the first time in years, he's an optimistic man.
When you go near the river, you'll be able to see how many things we're growing now. We are growing vegetables, the small grasses, and every kind of fruit trees.
A 30-minute drive to the north, a bulldozer takes away the rubble of three large family homes. 25-year-old Musla Ibrahim stands atop the rubble of his uncle's house. Until the war, he lived here with his family. He explains eight of his cousins perished when the Americans bombed his house.
I was asleep in my house a block away. It was 10 minutes before 6 a.m. when the first bomb hit. I ran out. All of the houses had been smashed. We couldn't help any of them because there was another aircraft above. We just ran away from the second aircraft. After the second missile strike, we tried to save them, but it was too late.
Like many of his Arab neighbors, Musla Ibrahim moved away from here after the war, selling his land to a Kurdish family at a fraction of its value. Now he lives 2 hours away in Mosul. He has no job, so he's returned to the site of his former home to think.
In the past, it was better. It was more comfortable than now. The situation is not stable. There are shootings and bombings and explosions. It's not a good time. In the past, we were comfortable and free. We could go to Mosul anytime, even if it was midnight. But now, it's not secure. And daily, some people are killed or murdered.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in northern Iraq.
A preparatory assembly for the third European Social Forum was held in Istanbul to discuss agenda items for the upcoming October European Social Forum. Our correspondent Ezgi Sarıtaş reports.
Organizations like Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace and Fort International were some of the participants in attendance, as well as several Turkish organizations.
One issue of significance was the fate of Cyprus and the referendum vote scheduled for April 24th. Recently, the Greek Cypriot president Tassos Papadopoulos called for the rejection by his supporters of the UN plan. Berna Yıldız is an analyst at East Mediterranean University.
It is always the government who debate the Cyprus issue. Cypriots do not need more plans. They need to communicate and find solutions together.
The European Union is in support of the UN plan and has urged all voters on both sides to accept the plan, which will be rewarded with an EU and US investment of $800 million. If either of the parties rejects the plan, then only the Greek Cypriots will begin to enjoy the benefits of joining the EU. Critics of the EU say that integration may not help Cyprus economically. Michael Curtis is a member of Greek section of Fourth International.
Powerful of the European community as the liberal governments of each national, they'll try to use the cheap worker power for their profit.
The UN plan calls for the return of over 120,000 Greek refugees and will allow the Turkish army to remain at a reduced number. Greek Cypriots lost their homes when Turkish troops seized the northern third of the island in 1974 after a coup by Greek Cypriots seeking unification with Greece. On the final day of the assembly, demonstrators took to the streets to protest US aggression in Iraq. The next production assembly for the European Social Forum will be in Berlin. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaş from Istanbul, Turkey.
Tomorrow is the 50th birthday of Mumia Abu-Jamal, an anti-death penalty activist. Human rights groups and civil rights activists from around the world will gather in Philadelphia to celebrate the strength of the death row journalist and commentator and call for his freedom. Asada Shakur calls Mumia the Malcolm X of our day. And we here at FSRN want to thank Mumia and the Prison Radio Project for his regular contributions to our newscast. With another commentary from his death row cell, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For millions of Americans, history is a muddling puzzle, and that, American history. When one looks at world history, the puzzle only gets larger and even more impenetrable. For them, Afghanistan, an ancient nation the size of Texas in the heart of Asia, only became real in the dusty, fear-drenched aftermath of 11 September 2001. Except for brief references to the decade of war with the former Soviet Union, most have little idea of Afghanistan's long martial traditions. This is seen in that nation's role in what is called the Great Game, or imperial conflicts between the British and the Russians, dating from the early 19th century. At the time, Tsarist Russia sought to expand her imperial borders south into what Peter the Great called the warm waters of the Indian Ocean. This area, however, was claimed by the British Raj, or colonial India. In their midst was the Kingdom of Afghanistan. Russia initiated European intervention by pushing the Persian Qajar Shah to attack Herat in Afghanistan's west, seen as the gateway to India. The British countermove was to send forces and materiel to defend the city of Herat. To resist Persian efforts, a fleet of British ships sailed into the Persian Gulf, thus checkmating Russian efforts on the region around 1837 and 38. In the next 80 years or so, the Afghans would fight three wars with the British, winning every one. The last Afghan-Anglo war ended in 1919. By this time, the British turned over much of the imperial duties to the Americans, and the Tsar gave way to the Soviets. While the protagonists have changed, the game remained, albeit one played by the rules of the Cold War. By the 1980s, the game was again afoot, as the U.S. sent in clandestine arms and support to elicit a Soviet military response, and to spring what Carter-era National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski would later call the Afghan Trap. Afghanistan became the Soviet's Vietnam as it lost tens of thousands in the war and led to the eventual breakup of the USSR. With the entry of the military of the U.S. into Afghanistan to topple the multinational Taliban government, a new round of the great game is now in play. With a military strategy of relentless air power and heavy bombings, and ground forces under what's called the Northern Alliance, the Taliban has been overwhelmed in battle. In a matter of weeks, they lost virtually every acre of ground. Yet even this state of affairs is but another stage of the great game, with some old players rolling the dice. For the truth is that the Taliban was a client state under Pakistani and Saudi tutelage, with Kabul and many other major cities in Afghanistan under the control of the so-called Northern Alliance. The Saudis and Pakistanis are displaced, and Russia has its hands on the prize that 10 years of war could not acquire. It is not, as Peter the Great once coveted, the warm waters of the Indian Ocean that whets Russian appetites, but black gold, oil under the Caspian Sea that will fuel industrial production for the next half century. The great game plays on, as ever, for wealth and power. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
For the first time in history, women of color have been included in the organizing of a march for reproductive justice to be held in Washington, D.C. this weekend, but not without a struggle. When women from around the country rally on Sunday, they'll be demonstrating for access to health and childcare, job security for pregnant women, and the right to choose to have a child. These developments are thanks to a strong influence from organizations serving women of color around the country. Shanina Shumate from the Welfare Radio Collaborative at the National Radio Project in Oakland has more.
On Sunday, April 25th, for the first time in 12 years, activists from around the country will be converging on Washington, D.C. in what they call a March for Women's Lives. They are demanding that the United States uphold women's rights to reproductive justice, choice, access, healthcare, and more. Loretta Ross is the co-director of Next Sunday's March and the executive director of the National Center for Human Rights Education.
Whether it's violence against women, whether it's the attack on abortion rights, whether it's the substitution of abstinence education for quality sex education, or whether it's the war in Iraq that is really ballooning the deficit and costing us social programs, the world's women join us in solidarity in saying no.
Historically, women of color have been excluded from mainstream feminist organizations. Women of color contend that this is the first time that the issues important to them have been taken seriously, but only because they put pressure on the organizers. Luz Alvarez Martinez is the executive director and co-founder of the National Latina Health Organization.
As the mainstream is looking at abortion, they're really not calling in women of color to weigh in their issues, their concerns.
Women of color organizations have expanded the concepts included in the march to begin with access to abortion, but to include larger concepts of reproductive justice. Dana Jen Paredes is an organizer with Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice, formerly known as Asian and Pacific Islanders for Reproductive Health.
Women and girls have reproductive justice when we have the power and resources and information to make empowered decisions for herself and her family in all areas of life. This is at school, this is at work, and this is within her home and within her community.
Loretta Ross says that for women of color, the concept of choice has a different meaning.
They say that women on welfare are having too many babies, or women are threatening the environment, or our children are responsible for the crime in the country. And so our right to have a child is as important as the right not to have a child.
In the United States alone, 36 million women of color do not have access to adequate health care. 90% of the counties in America do not have an abortion clinic. And because of the global gag rule reinstituted by President Bush, reproductive health and sexual rights organizations around the world have had their funding cut. Luz Alvarez Martinez says that reproductive justice has as much to do with access as it does with choice.
So it is not just about abortion, it's about having access, economic access, geographic access, cultural access, and language access.
Loretta Ross says commonly ignored economic factors impede real reproductive justice. She contends that the failure of the U.S. government to create and implement laws that deal with women's real needs has caused an economic crisis.
Real women with real lives have to worry about child care, have to worry about whether or not the neighborhood is safe, have to worry about whether they can afford the housing or can they afford the health care premium.
May Saipan is a youth activist at Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. She says that she will be attending the march next Sunday and that it is time to get active.
We can't just, like, sit there and be doormats. We gotta, like, raise up, stand on up, and raise our voices and be like, we're not taking it. You know, these issues affect not just Caucasian females, but Southeast Asian females as well as other women of color. And we're not gonna take it no more.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shanina Shoemate with Renita Pitts, Kimberly Ross, and Sarah Olson of the Welfare Radio Collaborative at the National Radio Project.
And as we close our newscast today, we bring you voices of women who are homeless in Albuquerque, New Mexico, produced by Rogi Riverstone from KUNM. A very special thanks to the staff and volunteers at KUNM, from where FSRN was produced this week. Rogi Riverstone and the voices of the homeless women in New Mexico.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I was homeless. And the hardest thing I had to do was to give my son up for just the 10 days I was homeless. Because my son was a teenager. He dropped out of school. I finally have gotten him turned around. And I've gotten myself turned around. Since my divorce, that's what made me homeless.
Hi, my name is Kathy Padilla. I came out here about a year ago from Las Vegas, Nevada to run a recovery program. Well, after running it for 4 months, I was laid off. I had no place to go. At the recovery program, I had a house, I had a car, I had everything, and ended up in the street.
My name is Jasmine Holmstrup, and I am the Director of Development with El Ranchito de los Niños, a children's home here in New Mexico. I've been asked by Barrett House to read a letter from the Good Shepherd Center, which happens to be the building where they are located currently. Albuquerque has a critical need for services for homeless women and children, a population that is increasing alarmingly. We see this increase in our meal service at the Good Shepherd Center. In 2003, we served 42,000 more meals than were served the year before. Much of this increase is due to an increase in homeless and impoverished women and children in our city.
Geraldine D'Amato.
As a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, of course, it's restricted as to what it can do to challenge the premises of homelessness. And short term, there's other things that need to be done as well. For example, in this state, I haven't heard any lobbying to change it, but in 3 days, if you're late on rent, you can be evicted from your premises no matter what your financial situation is.
Stanley Weinstein, I'm the vice president of the Barrett House board. It's a situational type of homelessness. It could be an economic circumstance. It could be a situation of abuse. And very often what you find is that the women and children find themselves in that category. But the good news is they're the population that could be the most helped. And if they're not helped, they're victimized once again, and it's a very dangerous situation to be a woman on the streets.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Our producers are Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Mylan, and Lindsay Benedict. We have help from Eric Klein and Amma Bwadi. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. To find out more or for our archives, visit www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.